Here we go. Good afternoon. Today is February 20th, 2017. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today, colleagues, we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 5008, the Employment Relations Board. And so we'll get that public hearing open. Why don't we start off getting an update from LFO on where we're going to go with this public hearing.
Good afternoon, co-chair, members of the subcommittee. Before you will be the Employment Relations Board, as you noted. There's some good information posted on OLIS, the normal information, and that is the governor's budget for the agency's presentation, the LFO and CFO analyses. And then the agency has also very kindly prepared an FAQ on their state agency assessment. And you've heard about state agency assessments. There's a specific to the agency with some good history and background there. And also, just one last thing, there is also posted some of the written testimony from stakeholders that are coming through. And just as a reminder, especially to agencies that may be listening, the mailbox for the subcommittee is just for that such purpose, and it's that's what it's devoted to. So anyway, that's about it, co-chair.
Perfect. Thank you. So Adam, come on up. Welcome.
Thank you.
If you could just introduce if you folks would introduce yourselves for the record, we'll turn this over to you and off we'll go.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. My name is Adam Ryder, and I'm the chair of the Employment Relations Board.
Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office.
The floor is all yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Again, my name is Adam Reinard. I'm the chair of the Employment Relations Board. We are the state agency that's charged with resolving disputes concerning labor and employment relations concerning 3,000 employers and about 250,000 employees, mostly in the public sector. We do have some private sector jurisdiction, but almost exclusively what we do is in the public sector. And as you can see, we are a small agency, particularly in reference to the relatively large statutory responsibility that we have. We're just 13 FTEs. It's somewhat unusually structured in that we have three board members who are all appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate for fixed four-year terms. We have our board administration section, which we have our business operations administrator and a board assistant who's a legal secretary. And the business operations administrator, even though that position is housed in board and administration, really has overall a supervisory authority across all the divisions in the agency and is really the manager of the agency. Two other divisions, Hearings and Conciliation Services, and I'll talk in detail about these different divisions and what they do as I go through the presentation. But just very briefly, we have three administrative law judges, or ALJs. They have a legal secretary that's assigned to assist them in their work, and we have a 0.5 FTE elections coordinator. Over on the Conciliation Services side, we have the state conciliator with two mediators. And again, we have a 0.5 FTE mediation coordinator. And again, I'll go in detail as to what these folks do as I go throughout the presentation.
Perfect.
So we're statutorily charged with administering three statutory schemes, two of which are really the primary bulk of our work. One is the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, which we call the PECBA, and the other is the State Personnel Relations Law, or we call the SPURL. Again, we do have some private sector labor management jurisdiction, but it's a very, very small slice of what we do overall. So if we look at these statutes and what are our statutory responsibilities, the first three bullet points really deal with the PECBA. And that is, again, we are a dispute resolution agency for basically every public sector employer, employee, labor organization in the state. So that's state agencies, local governments, you know, cities, counties, special districts, any sort of local public employer or employee. We have jurisdiction over labor and employment relations regarding those folks. The other statutory responsibility related to the PECBA is we're to implement the laws that protect the rights of employees to organize and negotiate collectively with their employers. And we're also statutorily charged with determining all representation matters regarding public sector employees, employees, and labor organizations. And by representation matters, generally what I mean is whether folks want to be part of a union or not. Their sort of choice as to whether they want to be collectively recognized in bargaining with an exclusive representative or not. That's representation matters. And then the last bullet point refers to, again, this borough, which is we resolve appeals from state employees regarding certain types of personnel actions. So certain types of state agency employees who might be non-union, also management service, have certain statutory rights if there's some personnel actions taken against them, say like a discipline or removal or a suspension, and they can appeal that to the board. So we have jurisdiction over those folks as well. So with those statutory responsibilities, we also have some statutory goals that are laid out for us by the legislature, and that is to develop cooperative relationships between the government and its employees. We want to provide an efficient dispute resolution mechanism to minimize the interruption of public services. Sort of the overarching goal of this is we want to protect the public by attempting to assure the orderly and uninterrupted functions of government. Labor strife, labor unrest, work stoppages, those are things that have a negative effect on the entire state, and we are the agency charged with trying to minimize that as much as possible. Lastly, again, improve employer-employee relationships by providing a uniform basis for employee choice and union representation. So if there's an issue that comes up, whether people want to be in or out of a union, they have an agency to go to that's going to give them a quick answer as to the appropriateness of that. Second. So how do we fulfill the legislative mandates? Here's our dispute resolutions. One is we are an adjudicatory agency, meaning people bring before us complaints under the PECPA, unfair labor practice complaints. It might be a public employer saying the union's bargaining in bad faith, or it could be the union saying the employer's bargaining in bad faith, or it could be an individual employee saying, hey, I'm not being fairly represented by my union, right? They can file a complaint with us, and we'll adjudicate that. The second is mediation. The conciliation services that I mentioned on the chart before with those mediators, those are folks that will go in and try to help something without necessarily going to litigation. So maybe there's a dispute about an unfair labor practice or a grievance, or maybe there's a dispute arising out of the collective bargaining process generally. Our mediators will go in there and try to get the parties on the same page. Mediators don't have the authority or the power to make parties agree to something, but they can try to use the tools and resources to try to get them to come to a common agreement. Again, processing petitions concerning employee representation by a labor organization. As those sort of come in, and whether it's, again, a union wanting to represent a group of folks, or it's a group of employees saying we don't want to be represented, they file petitions before us and we resolve those in a timely fashion. And lastly, we maintain and provide a roster of qualified arbitrators. ORS 662.445 requires the agency to provide to maintain a list of arbitrators. So if the parties are having a problem, maybe a collective bargaining dispute or something along those lines, a grievance dispute, they might want to go to a third party, an arbitrator, have the arbitrator resolve that for them. And when that happens, they come to the board and they might say, hey, can you give us a list of arbitrators? And we provide that list to them. We'll give them a list. They'll select the arbitrator that we want. But we do provide that list for them in case there is any sort of grievance process or dispute resolution that requires an arbitrator. So moving on to fulfilling our legislative mandates, again, three basic ways. One is contested case hearings, the other is mediation, and the third is processing representation petitions. And I'm going to move back and forth between this slide and the next slide because I think maybe the best way to describe what we do is a little bit of a sort of a case flow chart to sort of walk you through kind of how something comes to our agency and how we might handle it. This chart might be a little bit busy, but we can use it as a little bit of a reference point as I just sort of walk through kind of what we do. So the first thing that happens, let's start at the bottom. A contested case is filed. And what is the contested case? It's like I mentioned before, it might be an unfair labor practice complaint that's brought by an employer or an employee or a labor organization. Or it might be an individual employee with a state agency who's filing a spurl appeal with us. So they'll bring that in. They file that case with us. It's then going to get assigned to one of our three administrative law judges, our ALJs. First thing that the ALJ is statutorily charged with doing is investigating that complaint or appeal. So they're going to look at that and say, does this warrant a hearing or not? You know, they're going to do an initial assessment of that, do an investigation. They might get an informal response from the other side. Hey, we got this filing. What is your position on this? After that investigation, they might look at it and say, for example, you know what, this is outside the statutory timeline for filing. It looks like it's just too late. So at that point, they might recommend dismissal to us, and you see that if they do that, that's going to go all the way up to the three-member board. The board is then going to look at that. If the board agrees with that assessment, we'll go ahead and issue an order dismissing the case. If we don't agree with it, if we say, you know what, it looks like there might be a fact here or two that's at issue that really warrants a hearing, we'll send that back to the ALJ, and then the ALJ will conduct a hearing. And you go up to that next line where it says hearing. So the ALJ will conduct a contested case hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act. It's a semi-formal hearing. It's not quite as formal as a courtroom procedure. You know, all the rules of evidence don't apply in our proceedings, but we have rules that sort of guide it involving examination, cross-examination. So it's a semi-formal legal proceeding. The ALJ is going to hear the evidence. Typically, then, the parties are going to submit written arguments or briefs after the hearing that the ALJ will consider. And then the ALJ will issue a recommended order. And then that order will come before the board, and that might become before the board with objections or without objections. So a party might have specific objections to it and sort of lay those out. In that case, what's going to happen is we're going to schedule oral argument for the parties and also allow them to put in some more writing before us to make their case. And then in either event, we will issue a board order. So if we go back to the slide for, at the bottom, processing representation petitions, again, assuring the right to opt for or against union representation, and go up to the top of this chart, it's very similar. We're going to get a petition that's filed that's asking us to do something involving representation. The election coordinator is going to look at that, see if it's a valid petition, and see if there are any objections to it. If there are objections, it's going to go down to the ALJ, and this whole process that I just talked to will go all over again. If there are no objections and it does happen to involve an election, the elections coordinator will work with the parties to come up with a consent election or agreement on how the election will be conducted. Say, you know, it's a straight-up representation petition where a new group of folks are deciding whether or not they want to be represented by a union or not. They will have an election, and there'll be a yes or a no sort of answer that we will then certify. All right, so same thing with mediation. Remember the other side of the chart that I put forth, the conciliation services with mediation? This is very similar. We do lots of types of mediation. What I'm going to focus on right here is really what's sort of required mediation under the PECPA. And, excuse me. Under the PECPA, if the parties have bargained in good faith...
Really quick.
Yes.
You used an acronym. Explain that acronym.
Sorry, the PECPA, the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. So that's one of the two statutes that I'll be referring to. One is the PECPA, and the other I'll say is the SPURL, and that's the State Personnel Relations Law.
Perfect.
The PECPA is the one, again, that really concerns the rights of what we'll call sort of labor organization and public employers. So after 150 days of bargaining... either party can request the assistance of a mediator. The part, you know, they can also jointly agree to that beforehand. But after 150 days of bargaining, they're going to ask, they can ask for mediation. The mediator's then going to come in and try and mediate that dispute over this collective bargaining contract. After 15 days of mediation, then either side can declare impasse. You see that little box that goes down there, the impasse. If they declare an impasse, they have 7 days then to file a final offer with the board, which each side's final offer was that includes a cost summary of what that final offer looked like. And then the mediator makes that final offer public, okay? Makes it public so the public can see what are the final offers of both sides, including the cost summary. We then enter what we call the sort of the cooling off period, which is a 30-day period under which the employees cannot go out on strike and the employers cannot implement. It's that cooling off period. When that cooling off period has happened, again, our mediators are hard at work trying to get the parties to come to a resolution. If after 30 days, though, after that final offer is posted, there is no agreement, then the employees, if they are strikeable employees, can go out on strike, and the employer can implement all or part of its final offer. Under Oregon law, most folks do have the right to strike. There are some folks who do not. Very generally speaking, those are public safety folks and transit district workers. So in that situation, sorry, if you go down under the mediation to interest arbitration, strike prohibited, for those folks who cannot strike, their final dispute resolution mechanism is final and binding arbitration. And that means they are both ultimately going to submit a last best offer to an arbitrator. And the arbitrator is going to decide whose contract most the overriding decision is what is in the public interest. But the arbitrator is then going to decide the contract for them, basically, if the parties can't come to an agreement.
Let me ask a quick question.
Sure.
Does either side have the ability to throw out the arbitrator and ask for a new selection? Kind of like a juror, you don't like that juror, we're going to get rid of that one?
Co-Chair Smith, not really. Basically, the parties make that decision at first. We give them a list. They can reject the list. So they can look at that list and say, you know what, we don't like any of these people. Can you give us another list? We'll go ahead and give them another list.
But once the arbitrator's selected, then you're going down that court.
For the most part, there are some provisions, you know, for example, if there's a bias issue or something like that and someone makes a motion or along those lines. But for the most part, the answer is that's correct. They're stuck with that arbitrator.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So again, that is generally the process of how a general mediation case would sort of flow through. And again, if there is a strike or a final offer implementation, the mediators are still then working with the parties after that to try to get them to come to a resolution to end that strike or end that final offer implementation and get them to come to a common agreement. So just sort of a brief look at how the agency's been doing and its statutory charges. You know, there's a fair amount of turnover in the agency not too long ago. And if you look back at sort of early 2013, it was a newly constituted board, a couple board members in 2012, one in 2013. And, you know, we were approached with a situation where we really had an enormous backlog of cases, really long case processing times, delayed resolution of representation matters, and, you know, really lower mediation success rates. You know, a lot of folks were understandably frustrated by that. So 2013 to 15, we really charted a course to eliminate that backlog of cases, reduce the timelines for processing cases, coming up with internal deadlines and timelines for us to sort of get things done, reaching out to stakeholders, getting them involved in our processes. We established an ongoing rules advisory committee of equal parts labor and management to update our rules, which hadn't been updated for some time. And again, sort of looking at ourselves, what can we do? How can we streamline our tasks to make us a more efficient and effective agency? And in doing so, that, you know, highlighted the need for us to have a case management system, which was authorized by the legislature for this biennium, the first phase of that.
So really quick, let's go back to that last slide.
Sure.
Can you elaborate on how you eliminated backlog of cases? Give us some specifics of what steps you internally took to change that.
Co-Chair Smith, first there was sort of a collective meeting among the three of the new board members, and I don't know how to say this other than to say that we made sort of a firm commitment to each other to our stakeholders that whatever it took to eliminate this, whether it be, you know, working weekends, working late night, exchanging drafts at 9, 10 o'clock at night, whatever it was, we were going to get through that, and we were going to make this no longer an issue for the agency. Mm-hmm. We just would not accept the fact that there was that backlog, and collectively, again, and with respect to the ALJs, we said, listen, there's going to be some timelines for these recommended orders coming out. We need to move through these at a faster rate. Haven't had these before. We're going to start putting those in place. And we held to those. You know, were there times, you know, where we were beyond, you know, the time for a particular case, a deadline? Sure. You know, and in those cases, we would communicate then with the stakeholders saying, listen, this case is taking a little bit longer to resolve. We want you to know, though, we are working on it. Because a lot of times, you know, a situation is, particularly if there's a dissenting member and it's 2-1, you know, you're trying to work through those things and a case might take a little bit longer to do. But other than that, establishing those internal timelines and holding ourselves to that task, that's, I guess, the best I could say about that.
Well, I compliment you folks, because that was an issue for a number of years. And so it's nice to know that's behind us.
Thank you, Coach Hirschman.
Yeah, Representative Marsh has a question.
Yes, and you also referenced case managers, a team of case managers that came on during that period.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Marsh. No, what I mentioned was that a case management system, we sort of highlighted the need for a case management system, and that's something that we're currently working on right now, which I'll talk about a little bit later in terms of what that looks like, sort of a contract to come up with a case management system to make it a more efficient operation.
Great.
So looking at this current biennium, you know, all our pending cases are timely, a drastic reduction in time to process cases. You know, speaking to what Co-Chair Smith just mentioned, if you look at 2012, for example, you know, The average time for issuing a final order after it was submitted to the board was 132 days. If you look at 2016, that's 26 days. The recommended orders, again, 2012, 211 days on average for the ALJ to issue a recommended order. 2016, that number is now down to 69. So, then, again, the time processing of cases just dramatically improved. Again, I talked about the Rules Advisory Committee. That was a sort of very painstaking and sometimes tedious process, but I can say working with the stakeholders, again, equal members of labor and management, the board now has a fully updated set of rules that really reflect sort of current practice, current statute, and a much more consolidated and easier to read and much more readable set of rules for people to follow. Case management system, again, we contracted with NIC USA through DAS to come up with a case management system. We expect that to launch by the middle of this year. It's the idea then is that for the next biennium, we will then use that to implement an e-filing system so that our stakeholders can electronically file and make online payments as part of phase two of that case management system. Engaging in increased stakeholder outreach, you know, one of the things that we hear from folks is that they really want to know what's going on at the agency, and we've tried to do that by increasing our number of public meetings. We just a couple months ago held a continuing legal education lunch where we get feedback from folks and we say, hey, what do you want our agency to look like? What are we doing well? What are we not doing well? What can we do better? What are things that you'd like to see? So keeping up that relationship with our stakeholders and keeping them informed. So, again, we have an agency that looks like what they want it to look like. I won't go through all these. I'll just highlight a couple of them. I talked about the state personnel relations law, the SPURL. You know, we keep a digest that kind of collects all of our cases that we've done under that with different categories. And that's a digest that hadn't been updated since 2008. We've drafted an update to that through 2000 currently. We're hoping to have that published in the next month or two. And at the same time, we drafted a couple user's guides to our cases. So a lot of times with the SPURL cases, they're pro se or not represented by an attorney. So we've drafted a guide to sort of help march them through the process. What does this mean? What are my rights? Where do I go? You know, what is an ALJ? What is an administrative law judge? Just trying to explain to them how the process works. We've done one for the pro se folks and also one for practitioners just as an easy-to-use guide. And again, we finished drafting that. We hope to have that published really within the next month. The other thing I wanted to highlight off of this list concerns our conciliation services. You know, one of the things that we did in looking at what our conciliation services folks do, one of the things that they do in addition to mediation is provide training, particularly often training what's called interest-based bargaining or IBB. And that's training that we provide to employers and unions to really help them become more effective negotiators and help them with their collective bargaining. So we conducted a comprehensive survey. You know, what do you know about our training services? Have you used our training services? Are they good services? Are they bad services? What don't you like? What don't you, what do you like? And it really highlighted the effectiveness of our interest-based bargaining training program. Basically, two-thirds of folks that used it found it to be a better process than traditional bargaining. You know, almost 80% of those folks found that it really helped improve relationships between employers and labor organizations. But two out of the three reasons why people did not use IBB or weren't familiar with IBB in our training services is lack of access and lack of awareness that this program really even existed. So our state conciliator went out and we offered, low-cost, half-day training on effective bargaining in three locations. We did Bend, Medford, and Salem. We also offered one out in Pendleton. We didn't get the sign-up for that, but we did have some Pendleton folks come down to Bend. And that training really emphasized and really hit how successful and how tremendous this IBB training program is. Because of that, we've seen a tremendous spike in people asking for those services, asking us for IBB training and facilitation. And I'll show you a slide on that in a couple minutes. But if you look at even at fiscal year 15 to 16, we conducted over 90 facilitation sessions with nine different strike-permitted groups. Eight of those have already been resolved. One of those is still ongoing as part of a facilitation process. And two of those involved Portland State University and Portland Public Schools, which some of you may be aware were some of the more contested negotiations last go-around, and they requested training and facilitation services from our agency to help them in their bargaining this go-around. So key performance measures, we have seven of them. I'll sort of won't go through each of these for time purposes, but again, generally we're hitting the marks, and really six of the seven were in the green. If you look at sort of a history of how our KPMs have done, the green is sort of our target within 5%. If you go back to 2012 and see where we're at now, we're about at the 86% mark in the green in terms of where we're hitting on our key performance measures. The one area, you know, which is the area that's sort of highlighted for improvement, concerns our survey, where we're sort of some in the yellow, some in the red. And I think with that, a lot of it, we actually can improve by really actually doing a better job with the survey itself and kind of targeting folks that are actually using our services now. You know, our response rate on that survey is relatively low.
So is that KPM number seven?
That's correct. So if let me go back. Oops. Sorry. I'm hitting the wrong buttons. Go back. That is correct. That's KPM number seven. So and in three of those, you know, I said we're in the yellow, and three of them were in the red.
So I know, Representative Nierman, this is an issue that's important to you, these KPMs. Would it be possible for us to get a little more information on that KPM?
And the goals.
Yeah.
And the exact numbers.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman, absolutely. We can give you those KPMs. They're part of our binder, and we're happy to share those with you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So turning to the budget environment, again, we got 13 people that do the work. Our workload is really variable. It kind of depends on, you know, we're not an agency that sort of has oversight in the fact that we're sort of going out sort of, you know, soliciting cases and that sort of thing. It kind of depends on the work that comes to us, and that really sort of fluctuates depending on, you know, if there's new legislation out there, the economy. You know, state contract negotiations are cyclical. They really are centered around the sort of two-year budgeting cycle. So those state contracts that sort of come up every 2 years, again, other local contracts, highly variable in terms of when they sort of come to us. Again, as I noticed before, showing this next slide, our increased demand for training and facilitation. So if we look at our conciliation case filings, you see, you know, relatively flat, a little up and down, a little lower in 13, higher in 15, a little bit of a drop. But you look over at training and facilitation, the number of sessions that our mediators and our state conciliators have done, you see in 2013, just a couple. In 2014, they're conducting a little under 20 sessions. In fiscal year 15, almost 80 sessions, any trading and facilitation sessions, which is just a tremendous increase. And then in 2016, again, 55, just dramatically more training and facilitation sessions than we've done in the past. And I think part of that is attributable, again, to the sort of survey and the work that we went out and put out there to let people know that these services are available to you. And again, the high degree of effectiveness of these training and facilitation services once people have them. Hearings and elections. Again, the number's down a little bit the last couple of years. If you go back to 2008, 2009, the numbers are somewhat similar. But again, these tend to be variable, and the case filings really do tend to ebb and flow depending on the economy and lots of external factors. So what are our goals going forward? Again, we want to maintain that agency timeliness in responding to mediation requests and issuing recommended and final orders, continue that stakeholder involvement. One of the things that we're wanting to do is to implement an electronic filing system for our stakeholders, and that's part of meeting our mainstream technology enhancements. Providing a searchable online database of our orders. We have some searchable orders that are up there, but it's not really a database that's really easy for people to use. And we want to work on that so that people have that as an available resource to them. Promote and expand our training and conciliation services. Again, that's become a key part of the agency's work. So if we look at 15-17, the LAB summary, we have three pots of money. You know, one is the general fund, which about 54% of our budget at that time. The other thing, and the LFO had mentioned this early, is our other funds, state assessment, which again comprises about 40% of our budget. This is a per capita assessment on state agencies that helps fund our work that's performed on behalf of the state and its employees.
That'd be
So it was $1.92 for that year. Our estimate, you know, initially on this was $2.38. It's sort of a snapshot at a fixed point in time. We'd estimate that number will go down.
So is that per state employee? How does that assessment work? Educate this committee on that.
Co-Chair Smith, yeah, that's a state assessment per employees who are really subject to the jurisdiction. So it doesn't include executive service and those sorts of employees. So it includes people, though, that are subject to the board's jurisdiction.
Does that include higher education?
It does not, Co-Chair Smith, it does not include the university system now that they are out of that, but otherwise it would include any other, it just includes state agencies. So this is not local, so it's only state agencies for the most part. The answer to that would be no, because the university system's out of it and it doesn't include other local entities. This is the one part of our budget that's really focused on just state agencies.
Got it. Thank you.
Welcome. And then other fund fee revenue, again, about 6% of the budget. These are statutory fees for conciliation services, for filing unfair labor practice complaints and answers.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Can you go back one slide, please?
Sure.
Are you going to get into the reason why the state assessment increase is going up? It's a pretty significant increase in one biennium, so just... The drivers of that would be interesting to talk about.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Fahey, yes. This number is, again, sort of an estimate that we do. It's sort of a snapshot that we look at, sort of an early 2016 that's based on our expenditures, what that ending balance might look like, the estimated number of state employees. Again, it's just an estimate. I would expect once, now that we have closer numbers, that number will sort of drop by quite a bit.
Quick follow-up?
Yep, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I just looking at the materials that were prepared, it looked like the 13-15 biennium, that number was $1.65 per employee. So the trend is pretty steep curve there. So it'd be interesting to talk about that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, Representative Fahey, the number is really based on looking at what our expenditures, what portion of that is going to be state assessment, and then really it's just a formula based on the number of people that the assessment applies to. When the university system dropped off, we lost a lot of those people as part of that assessment, so that's one of the reasons why that number went up.
And let me share with the committee, John was just sharing with me that $1.92 state assessment is per employee per month. Not a biennium, but per month. So, yes, Senator.
One other thing is that one of the metrics that we look at this agency by is how fast they're moving the pig through the python. There have been instances where the caseloads were so phenomenal that it was ostensibly adjudication delayed was adjudication denied, and it was enormously problematic. Nobody was happy. Labor was angry. Management was angry. Everybody was angry. And so one of the accountabilities that when they come back that I want to make sure that we scrutinize, and there have been so many different managers and so are heads, this agency has had a couple of near-death experiences, but that one of the things that we're rigorous about asking is what's the time lag on the case adjudication? Have I lied about anything, Mr. Director?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, no, you have not. And I did just go over that, and I could go back over for you right before you got here.
No, don't.
Okay.
My fault I'm late. Don't replow.
Okay.
She's pretty familiar with this work.
I've helped scoop this one out of the deep end of the pool and administer resuscitation on more times than I can count.
Senator Johnson, it is appreciated. So if we look by the case management system that we talked about, again, phase one was authorized in 2015-17. This is a deliverables-based project with NICUSA through DAS. Again, we anticipate that that's going to launch the middle of this year. So this is a really sort of a complex and agency-specific software and build that they're doing for us. Again, this is because it's a deliverables-based contract, we don't pay anything for it until they get the work done for us. Phase two, we would then take that
Before you leave that, this is the second time in one day that NICUSA has come up in a conversation that I have been party to. They are a vendor, and what I want to assure ourselves, and maybe this is more a question to Mr. Borden than anybody else, that we do not fall into the thrall of these agencies who, once they are responsible for doing our, quote, deliverables-based project, that they have proprietary information that we're on the hook then to pay a gazillion dollars to get back. NICUSA is doing something for ODOT. I don't know what the scope of NICUSA is, and I can hear their lobbyists listening to this going, oh, we're doing great and wonderful things. And they'll be in my office tomorrow. But I just want to assure ourselves that we are not getting into a vendor relationship with no escape hatch.
Good point.
Mr. Co-Chair, if it's all right, can we note that so, John, we can have a conversation on that in the future?
Yes. And, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, you'll hear another one of your agencies, Government Ethics Commission, also with the NICUSA contract, so there's a theme here that you'll...
And I don't know whether these are negotiated, whether they're bid, whether they just sort of pass with a wink and a nod, and I am very concerned about us being stuck with proprietary contract vendors on IT stuff.
So, Senator, would you mind if... this is new to me. John, Mr. Co-Chair, maybe we have a little bit of conversation on this, and it might be worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Within this horribly busy schedule to find 10, 15 minutes where, as a committee, we can learn more about this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Co-Chair, maybe somebody from the Chief Information Office would, or the Department of Administrative Services would be best to come back, kind of set the stage, because this, again, is a vendor that is doing work across multiple state agencies. So. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Director, for bringing that up. Thank you, Senator, for highlighting that.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
Just a quick question. What's the nature of this software project? Is this commercial off-the-shelf, or is this something that you're building for your agency? And are there any ongoing life cycle costs for this?
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nierman. Yes, this is something that's being built specifically for our agency. So they're in with us sort of going through specifically working on a case management system that's really just targeted and specific to our agency. And yes, there are, as part of that, there would be sort of ongoing costs as part of the case management system. The next stage, again, that we're asking for one of our policy option packages is really phase two of that, which is to take that build of our case management system and then turn that into an electronic filing system for our stakeholders, so then they could log in and electronically file and do case management that way.
Thank you. And you'll be before the IT committee to talk about that then.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Co-Chair, thank you. Representative Nierman, you brought up a great point that in addition to what Senator Johnson says, because if this particular vendor is designing specifics per agencies, then that means that they are tapping into multiple resources. I'm kind of worried about that. Yeah, so we already said that we were going to dig into a little bit deeper, but thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to learn more about it. So,
it is an interest. It is a really great project. Actually, I'm very excited about it. Other policy option packages, we have a recently all grouped together an executive service compensation classification package. In December 2016, the e-board approved a DAS class and compensation change for the board members and the chair. We're also asking for, we're asking for ongoing funding for that. We're also asking for our business operations administrator, who is currently classified as a PEM B, to be reclassified. And again, that has been, that reclassification has been approved by CHRO. That's a position that, again, really is the overall office manager position, and there's really no dispute that the duties of that position meet that classification.
Senator Johnson.
Again, to call the chair's attention to this and maybe some additional investigation, I find it just confounding that ever since I walked in the door of this building, we've been talking about a class and compensation system at DAS. It never gets done. And yet, and in fact, this time we're going to cut people from that activity, at least as my cursory understanding of their budget. And yet we have these episodic engagements. Well, we managed to get a reclass of your office administrator through, and oh, we managed to get a chair compensation plan approved. But they seem to be in isolation, away from any kind of a comprehensive class and comp program that we're looking to DAS to produce for the state and have been looking for it for 15 years. And it just kind of annoys me. I would also just share with no particular pride that having run a state agency briefly, I wrote some reclassifications that were some of the finest works of fiction around. This was Pulitzer quality stuff. And I just think that these deserve some scrutiny. So I know there's a lot of pressure internally for the office manager, and I'm not singling her out, just as, or him or whatever. It's just an example. I do all this additional work, ergo I need a reclass. And all of this is happening in isolation with no objective standards that would give guidance to other agency heads to know how to reclass an office administrator. You don't have to respond. That was the, just a rant.
Let's continue. We have about 15 more minutes before I have to move to the rest of the public hearing.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Smith. I'll try to move this quickly. The state conciliator, again, this is classification and compensation plan change, really to remove the salary compression between that position and the two mediator positions that position oversees. And again, I can't really say enough about our tremendous state conciliator and the work that she does. I will discuss the arbitrator fee increases right here, which is under HB 2264. And you might recall earlier I mentioned that one of the statutory obligations that we have, that we've been charged with by the legislature, is to maintain a list of qualified arbitrators. And we've also been directed to charge a fee to do that. We've been directed to charge two fees. One is a $50 fee if an arbitrator wants to be on that panel to apply to it. And the other is an annual $100 fee to stay on that list. This is, again, that list that we maintain for folks. And then on HB 2264 proposes to increase that initial fee from $50 to $100 and the annual fee from $100 to $150 to remain on the roster. It's an estimated increase of $8,000 in revenue over the 17-18 biennium. If you look at FMCS, which is sort of our federal counterpart, they have $100 50 fee, annual fee for their list. California, the equivalent, again, $150 fee. The last time these fees were put in place was 2007, so they haven't been changed since then, and this is really meant to sort of reflect the sort of value of the service that we provide.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I just want to make sure that I understand this, because in negotiating fees for the for your agency in the past, we've gotten high-centered with the question of on whose burden does this fall? Is it on the labor side of the ledger or the management side of the ledger? As I understand this, this is purely a fee for someone who wishes to stay on the arbitrator's list to ensure that their name stays on it. It doesn't change the delicate balance of who pays.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, that's exactly correct. It is just a list for those private individuals who are arbitrators. Most of them are in Oregon and Washington. They're spread out over eight different states. If they want to be on our list, it's just for those folks to be on the list.
One last question.
Please.
How do you maintain quality assurance? I mean, you've got these people on the list. They pay a fee to be there. Do you track complaints for how your arbitrators are doing?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, yes, we do. So we do track that, and we do, if we do get complaints, that's one of the grounds which they could be removed from the list. So there is a list of criteria, and the quality of the work and the feedback that they get, if they're untimely with their awards, for example, that's a reason for removal from the list. We have a set of criteria that we sort of monitor, and just candidly, probably the main way that we would get that is through feedback from people. They would say, hey, this arbitrator's constantly late with, you know, his or her awards, that sort of thing.
So let me ask you about House Bill 2264, increasing the application fee from $50 to $100. It appears the pool is so small that the amount of additional revenue generated is as small as can be. what's the rationale for raising the application fee?
Co-Chair Smith, again, it's just to sort of keep up with the value of the service that we provide. There's actually a tremendous amount of work that goes, particularly at that initial application fee stage, because the arbitrators are going to, you're right, it is a small amount. We're a small agency. It is a very small amount. We're talking about 5 or 6 people a year that apply to the list, so it is a very, very small group of folks. As part of that, when that comes in, our mediation coordinator has to sort of look over that, pass it on to the state conciliator. As part of that, they have to meet a bunch of different factors, and they have to submit awards. Those awards then have to be reviewed by the conciliator and by the board chair to see whether or not they are meeting our criteria in terms of whether or not they are a qualified arbitrator. We don't want people on the list that are going to, you know, they're not going to meet the satisfaction, the needs, and the standards that our stakeholders have. So there's a fair amount of time that does go in, just labor time, work time, into processing and reviewing those applications. But you're correct. It's a small number, and it's a small number of folks. It's a small dollar amount.
Let's please continue.
That's all I have, unless I have any, there's any questions. That's it.
All right.
Except unless there are any questions.
Any questions? Senator, do you have a question there?
No.
No, you're good? Okay. All righty. Thank you, then.
Thank you.
CFO?
Yep, coming up.
Okay.
And I'll restate, I'm Michelle Lisper with the Chief Financial Office. Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members.
Welcome.
I'm going to do a brief highlight of the governor's budget. And some of this I'll probably skip over since Adam's already mentioned it. Some key emerging issues that he reviewed briefly: the local government makes up the majority of the agency's caseload, which a lot of that is covered through general funds. There have been big strides in their performance over the past few biennials that he mentioned, and the new board continues to focus on their improvements, which includes being responsive to stakeholders' needs. The governor's budget recognizes the mediations division's work and supports the efforts and practices of promoting the additional training in the areas of interest-based bargaining, labor management committee training in both local government and state agencies. This slide is showing you a little bit of historic 2013 and 15's actual of their expenditure history and FTE. If you notice, the FTE hasn't changed. There's still 13 positions ledge approved, and the 17-19. It's still pretty much almost a 50-50 split between other funds and general funds. Some of the big cost drivers for the agency. As previously indicated, the need for additional mediation services and training are attributed to mediation contested cases that are arbitrated for local government, and news case management system, which will assist the agency and stakeholders in tracking their cases as to where they are in the process, as well as having access to the materials online, is what pretty much what the new case management system is about. This is a split of expenditure categories. As you can see, 79% of their budget is personal services, and 21% is S&S. It's just another way to look at their budget. This chart gives you a little bit of history of actuals of general fund, the other fund assessment, which was indicated, which is a per person, per employee, eligible employee per month, and other fund fees. As you can see, the majority is between assessment and general funds, and a smaller amount is the other fund fees that are collected. So investments. Governor's budget is investing in the board members' new job classification or reclassification, the upward reclassification of their administrative office administrator, who has been working out of class. As already mentioned, the compression issue in the mediation service staff. Increase of other fund limitation to match the increased fees for the arbitrators, which is a small amount. Also upgrading their new online case management system, as they said, that will be launched mid-year. It will allow for electronic filing of payments, which also will help them expedite their cases and their caseloads rather than waiting on the snail mail to receive payments. As the last slide, the last bullet point that he mentioned was the arbitrator fees that match the federal schedule fees. And it's my understanding that there's stakeholder support for them from the arbitrators for there are no complaints about increasing the fees. And with that, that concludes a very high level and a wrap-up of the governor's budget. If there's any questions, let me know.
Any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. We appreciate the two of you.
Thank you.
All right. So, colleagues, we're going to move into the second portion of our public hearing. And let's see here. Who wants to come up first? Stephen, Brian, and Brian, you want to come on up? So what I'm going to do is kind of manage our time here. And what do you think? Is 4 minutes each enough time?
That for me.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
All right. You're Stephen.
I'm Steve Demarest, yes.
Perfect. Brian, are you around? Come on up, Brian. You'll be second in line. All right. Welcome. If you could just introduce yourselves for the record, the floor is all yours.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Manning, and members of the subcommittee, my name is Steve Demarest. I'm president of SAU 503. I'm also a state employee. During my career of state employment, I did some time in the human services section, human resources section of my agency, and I had occasion to observe ERB handle appeals by those that are covered by Spurl, I think as was referred to earlier. In my role as a union activist over the years, I participated in bargaining of state collective agreements, state collective bargaining agreements, and we've made use of the mediation services that were described earlier today. So I'm here today to testify in support of of the Employment Relations Board, ERB, budget, House Bill 5008, and the three policy option packages outlined in the governor's requested budget. SAU Local 503 is a union of 65,000 Oregonians doing more than 500 different jobs in 85 state, local government, and nonprofit agencies and care facilities. The ERB performs several vital functions that foster positive labor relations across all sectors of public employment and labor management relations. The ERB plays a vital role in assisting employers and unions, large and small, reach fair collective bargaining agreements through its mediation services. Those mediation services also lend assistance and training to employers and unions in resolving disputes between collective bargaining agreements. The ERB also effectively enforces the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, PECBA, through adjudication of alleged unfair labor practices filed to protect statutory and other legitimate interests of employers, employees, and labor organizations. We believe that full and sufficient funding is a necessary component for the ERB to perform all of those and other important functions with which it is charged. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Awesome. Thank you. Questions? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Manning, Co-Chair Smith, members of the subcommittee. My name is Brian Caulfield. I'm the Director of Labor Relations Services with the University Shared Services Enterprise, USSE. Established through statute, USSE provides essential supports to Oregon's public universities, allowing each to focus on mission-critical and student-centered outcomes. USSE offers over 30 services, including one statutorily mandated service, within six service areas. The seven public universities utilize these six service areas. Five of the seven universities participating in 16 or more services. I direct the statutorily mandated service, which is collective bargaining negotiations with SEIU Local 503, the labor organization that represents the classified employees at all public universities. To give you a sense of the scope of these negotiations, the collective bargaining agreement covers roughly 4,400 employees and equals approximately $563 million in wages and benefits per biennium. In my role, not only do I represent the universities in collective bargaining negotiations, arbitrations, and unfair labor practices with SEIU, but also other labor organizations representing faculty, grad students, and other employees such as stagehands at Portland State. So a significant portion of my work is and can be before the Employment Relations Board, and I support ERB's funding requests and its priorities that it seeks to accomplish with that funding, as all have significant impact on the public. Specifically, Policy Option 100, ERB seeks a compensation plan change for the state conciliator to relieve salary compression between this position and the other mediators. Retention of top talent is crucial to the success of any organization. Time and again, the state conciliator, Janet Gilman, has delivered results to the public universities. In no fewer than the three instances in my 4 years in doing this job, Ms. Gilman has successfully assisted the universities with concluding negotiations without strikes. These strikes could have had a detrimental effect to the public service provided by our universities. In addition, in fiscal year 15 and 16, Ms. Gilman's office conducted over 130 IBB training and facilitation sessions and provided low-cost, effective bargaining training sessions throughout the state. And one of those was, as Chair Reinhard mentioned, the Portland State University requested the services of ERB in interest-based bargaining after very contentious negotiations, and it was very successful in the following round of negotiations. Her investment in this, in the people of this state, is invaluable. To lose her to the private marketplace because of compensation would be, in my view, penny-wise, dollar-foolish. Policy Option 101 is near and dear to my heart because I served on the ERB's Rules Advisory Committee. And we have just spent the past 2 years streamlining ERB's rules with an eye towards efficiency. Phase two of the case management system provides for e-filing system that allows users to electronically file a variety of documents and make electronic payments. As a former field attorney with the National Labor Relations Board and a practitioner before that agency, I can personally attest to the efficiencies gained from the use of an e-filing system. Not only does it produce efficiencies, but allows practitioners to review recent filings to determine trends, potentially assess strengths and weaknesses of their own cases. So this policy option brings ERB into the 21st century in line with its federal counterpart and gives it the necessary tools to continue its effective operations into the future. In closing, I just want to borrow a line from my colleague Mr. Tedesco's written remarks. He said, management and union lawyers don't always agree on much, but when it comes to a well-funded and efficient Employment Relations Board, we do stand united, and I urge you and your respective colleagues to support the funding requests. I'll take any questions if you have any.
Awesome. Any questions?
I just have a little one.
Yeah, so, Representative.
I thought I remembered Mr. Reinhard said that the ERB was no longer working with the Oregon University system, or the event doesn't exist anymore. So you said that the PSU or something like that was...
To my knowledge, when the universities request the services of ERB, we're billed separate and apart.
Correct.
Yes.
Is that the same for, if I can follow, please?
Please.
So is that the same for, like, counties and cities then? So
I don't have knowledge to answer that question. Unfair. Sorry.
I think I can answer that, but I'll let John
take that. Mr. Co-Chair and Representative, the university system has moved from the assessment side of the house to the general fund side of the house. Mm-hmm. Which is similar to other local governments.
Okay, I get it. Okay.
All righty. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
We're sure glad you were here today. All right. How about Mike, why don't you come on up, and Bob, come on up. Howdy.
Hello.
We're glad you're here. If you could just introduce yourself for the record, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Michael Tedesco. I'm a founding partner of Tedesco Law Group. We represent public organizations, unions, and associations in the state. There are six lawyers in my office. I also teach labor relations law and arbitration law at the University of Oregon Law School. And I frankly am so in support of what ERB is doing. ERB, as Senator Johnson mentioned earlier, went through a pretty rough phase a few years back. And I'm here to report on behalf of my observations as a practicing attorney before the board. And I might say I've been doing it for 40 years almost, that ERB is in great shape compared to any other state agency I deal with. And I can say that without equivocation. The work done by the current chair and the former chair, Chair Logan, who obviously is retired, was exceptional. Mm-hmm. We have moved to the point where it's no longer a situation of justice delayed as justice deferred. Cases are coming out, and the administrative law judges are doing their job, and I think we can all take a fair amount of pride in the fact that there were many of us that were upset about that in the past and made our voices heard. I particularly want to focus my remarks on the state conciliations services. Kind remarks were just made about the state conciliator, Janet Gilman. I can't begin to tell you what a relief it is to be representing a client and to have both labor and management smile when Janet walks in the room. It's not just because of her personality, it's because of how good she is. I've been amazed. I've known Janet for many, many years, and I have always been amazed that she didn't leave to go work for the Federal Mediation Service, which operates out of Portland. She would increase her pay by about 50%. But she's committed to doing the work of the people of the state of Oregon, and she has done it in the most difficult of circumstances. And she and her mediators have been just a terrific asset. And frankly, they deserve our support. Too little support, in my view, has been given to mediation services up until the last few years at ERB. When I started many, many years ago, we had 6 or 7 mediators handling less of a caseload than the 3 we have now. Mm. And they're just doing tremendous work. I'd also like to add my support for doing something about the pay for the office administrator. It really needs to happen. There's been turnover, and if recruitment and retention means anything, it seems to me that person needs to get reviewed. And I'm mindful of what Senator Johnson was saying about DAS and the work that they do, and it seems like when on behalf of other unions, I've made an agreement that DAS will do a comp study on a particular classification. I'm thinking ODOT. It just seems to go into this hole and never comes out. And I acknowledging that problem, and I realize that we're asking you to do something piecemeal. At least I'm asking you to do something piecemeal. These people really deserve it. And they're doing a wonderful job, and they're saving the state a lot of money, a lot of disruption. And I think it's just really important. So they have my complete support for the package that's before you. And I'll take any questions that you might have.
Perfect. Senator Johnson.
I feel compelled to respond. I'm not going to take it out on this office administrator that DAS isn't doing their job. So I wanted you to be reassured. And for the benefit of some of our new colleagues, my first exposure to ERB, I was sort of quizzical about how the whole thing worked. And with the help of Mr. Livingston and Duke Shepard and Mary Bodkin helping to explain to me that the principal function of ERB is just what we've heard, and that is to provide that forum to ostensibly maintain labor peace in the state. It is the place where these cases are resolved. And coming from a pretty dark time to now a very efficient, effective, perceived as fair, in reality, I would say fair. And that has certainly not always been the case. But I thank you for your testimony, and I just wanted you to go away reassured that I am not going to visit the sins of DAS on one office administrator.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Co-Chair Smith, committee members, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and entering my 25th year in the fire service here in Oregon. And I would be smart simply to just say what he said, but I'm not that smart. So just a couple other points that I'd like to echo, and I'll just take 30 seconds. And that's one of the things that's important about this committee is the fact that while it's every dollar counts, the footprint they have on the public workforce in the state of Oregon is considerable. And so when you look at that and you balance all the budgets and all the work that you're going to do in ways and means, keep that in mind. The second point that I would like to echo is the other thing that's unique is while Mr. Chair Reinhardt did a great job, he's a great speaker, keep in mind that there's three members of the Employment Relations Board. There's an attorney that represents management, there's an attorney that represents labor, and then there's a neutral. But by the fact that someone has to be the chair of the committee, they also have to do some of that administrative work. And so not to have to relive the past, because certainly I don't want to relive the past, I would certainly recommend that some of these POPs are get to continue to put things in the right direction. And up to this point, a lot of this has been by the fact that I think you heard the chair say this. We had three board members that simply said, we're going to buckle down and get the work done. But I think the next step, there's only so much you can ask of three individuals. I think some of these POPs that you have in front of you in this budget will help do that, whether that's e-filing, whether that's making sure you have appropriate compensation plans so that at the end, a person like Chair Reinhardt, while he does a great job with it, can really do what he needs to be doing, and that's hearing cases and adjudicating things and managing the agency. And so with that, I'm very pleased, and I think, particularly to Senator Johnson, yourself, Mr. Co-Chair, and others that have been involved in this process in the past. This really is a phoenix rising, and we're very happy with where things are.
We remember where it's been in the past, don't we?
Yeah.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. We're so glad you were here today. All right. We have one last speaker. Tyler, come visit us. Is there anyone else who wants to share a thought with us? All right. Tyler, you're up.
Fantastic. So, Co-Chair Manning, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee, my name is Tyler Shipman. I am with the Oregon School Employees Association. We represent over 21,000 school educational employees. I'm here today on behalf of support of this bill, House Bill 5008. I'll try and be brief. Most of what has been said already is things that we agree with. We have bargain units in over 100 school districts that, and as you can imagine, this makes us rely pretty heavily on the ERB, especially for issues relating to collective bargaining. We're before them very often for unfair labor practices or using their mediation services. I can speak personally to a mediation I was a part of where we met at 3 p.m. and it ended at 6 a.m. and it was a nonstop mediation session. We did that three more times before we were able to get agreement from the parties. That's the kind of work that happens here. Without that, I'm not sure if we would have been able to find agreement without having to go to either implementation or strike. And that's what's really important for us, is to avoid those things and for the parties to both be happy with each other when it's over and get back to work. So we fully support the requested budget for everything that it does. We understand the importance of hiring and retaining quality in professionals in this type of work. I think that if we were unable to do that, we'd go back to how it was, and we'd also be at a disadvantage, not just my association, but I think all public sector associations as well. So I'm available for any questions if you have any.
Perfect. Any questions? You're off the hook.
Sweet.
All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
One last chance. Anyone want to speak in this very important public hearing? All right. Thank you for that chance. John, is there anything we need to think about as we wrap up the day?
Co-chair and members of the subcommittee, you're on a little bit of a victory tour this week. So you're going to hear some other success stories, I hope. So this is going to be should be a very good week. ERB has just finished up Construction Contractors Board tomorrow, State Library, and then the last one, pardon me, Ethics Government Ethics Commission, which is also doing well on Thursday. Thank you, Michael. So the information has been posted on OLIS for each of them.
Perfect. All righty. Mr. Co-Chair, any final thoughts? Are you good?
I'm good, Co-Chair. Thank you.
You're good? Michael, we good?
Yes, sir.
All right. See no other business before us. We're going to adjourn for the day.
So, next.
Other business before us. We're going to adjourn for the day.